Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. The programme is coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. Voting is well underway in most of the United States in a presidential election considered too close to call. Tens of millions of early ballots had already been cast before the very first polls opened in Vermont at 5 a.m. local time today. The campaign has seen assassination attempts on the Republican candidate Donald Trump and the withdrawal mid-race of President Biden in favor of Kamala Harris. The winner is expected to be decided by the results in seven so-called swing states. This is what Donald Trump said to journalists after he voted in Florida.
No, I feel very confident. I have felt, you know, we went in with a very big lead today. And it looks like Republicans have shown up in force. So we'll see how it turns out. But it seems that they have really shown up in force.
Kamala Harris appeared at the Democratic headquarters in Washington. She was given a warm welcome as she helped aides phone people to encourage them to get out and vote. Earlier, Kamala Harris dialed into radio shows in battleground states. Speaking to the radio station KDKA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the vice president responded to Donald Trump's campaign claim that she had broken the U.S. immigration system. She said there'd been a way to fix the border issue, but that Donald Trump had decided against it.
Congress, through the United States Senate, some of the most conservative members came up with a bill, which I supported, to put more resources into putting more agents at the border, more resources into combating human trafficking. And sadly, my opponent told them to kill it, to not do it, because he wants to run on a problem instead of fixing a problem.
Kamala Harris earlier. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy is in Wisconsin, a key election swing state in what's known as the U.S. Rust Belt, northwest of Chicago.
Hello from Cedarburg. It's a lovely old mill town. It's a bit of an overcast afternoon, I have to say, here. I'm in Ozaukee County. It's one of the counties just north of Milwaukee, the biggest city in this state, which is being very closely watched, these three counties, because they are counties which have traditionally been Republican, but have been trending towards the Democrats. And just to give you one example, here in Cedarburg, 63% of people voted for the Republican in 2012. 55% in 2016. That was Donald Trump, of course. And last time, 4 years ago, Joe Biden won this town by 19 votes. It is very close here. Wisconsin, always very close, but the last two elections, just by 0.7%, they've been decided. First to Donald Trump, then to Joe Biden. So people are wondering what is going to happen here now. And I've been out to a few polling stations during the course of the day. I have to say, a lot of people voted early here. Maybe two-thirds have voted early by post or in person, which will be interesting when it comes to the timing of the counting of the votes. But people were turning up today. And I went to the town hall here in Cedarburg to hear from some of the voters.
My name is Mike. This is my mother, Mariette. I am a blue patriot, if that makes any sense. I could not bring myself to vote for Donald Trump.
So it's not policies, it's the man?
Yeah, it's him.
Maybe I could ask your mother.
Sure.
How did you vote, ma'am?
For the right person, I'll say that.
Is that the same way as your son?
Yeah. Trump is, I think he's losing it. Let's put it that way.
Well, what I do is I focus on policy. I'm not selecting a president, either one, to be my spiritual leader. I have someone that does that. So for me, it's policy.
So which policies were important for you?
I think economic policy and more accountability in how we spend our money. It sounds extremely unnecessarily wasteful that money could have been used in much more positive ways.
So it's policies, not people, but it will be a person who is president of the United States after this election. How did you see that choice?
Are you asking me how I voted?
I am asking you how you voted, sir, yes.
I voted for Donald Trump. I have some concerns about what I'll call leadership style. He makes some comments that I just go, really?
But do you still think he's the best person for the job?
Without any doubt. To me, it's not even close.
I think the economy is a big, big thing for me. I really feel that when you have such high gas prices, it really drives the price of everything up. So I do think the economy is a big thing for me.
So you felt that, have you, personally? You felt
the
impact of that?
Definitely. I'm in the middle of a bathroom remodel, and I wish I had done it several years back, because the price of everything, the materials and the workmen and everything is really gone up significantly.
Does it come down to that, do you think? Do you think this election will be decided on the economy?
You know, I don't know. I think they're really pushing abortion. That's a really big issue for some people. And as a woman, I guess it's strange. It's just not a really big issue for me. I pray that the Lord knows what he's doing. I pray that he's going to protect us.
Well, look, nice to talk to you, sir. Can I just ask your name, perhaps?
Wayne.
And could I ask you how you voted?
Straight Republican.
Straight Republican. Are you always straight Republican kind of guy?
Yes.
And important for you that Donald Trump becomes president again?
Yes.
Why? What's the most important?
Because of the alternative.
What would that mean if Kamala Harris wins, do you think?
Well, she doesn't know what's going on half the time. She's incompetent, I think, so she doesn't deserve that.
I'm nervous.
Are you?
Mm-hmm. About my fellow Americans, our Constitution and our democracy.
And you think, what, one of the candidates is a threat to that?
Yes, I do. I think Mr. Trump is ought to be in jail. You can quote me. Who cares what I think in London? But that's what I think.
Some voters there in Wisconsin. Jamie, what needs to happen to declare a winner? It's a fairly long process, potentially, isn't it?
Yes, potentially. In states like this, especially where it's likely to be a tight race, it could take some time. I was here 4 years ago in Pennsylvania. We had to wait until the Saturday for it to be declared. As I said, what complicates things is the propensity now to vote early. And some states have rules where you can actually send in a postal vote. In Nevada, you can send in a postal vote today and it's counted as long as it arrives on November the 9th. But places like Wisconsin, they started to tabulate the postal votes and the early in-person votes this morning, but they still don't think they'll get a result. Perhaps the early hours of the morning is the most hopeful. 4 years ago here in Wisconsin, it was at middle of the day the following day. So that's a sort of guide, perhaps.
And because of the huge geographical spread of votes, it's a long voting process too, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, the polls close earliest on the East Coast and move across to the West Coast. We're sort of somewhere in the middle. But look out for states like Georgia. I think that's the first of the swing states, the key seven or so states where it looks pretty close in all the opinion polls to declare. They might get results fairly early there, it would appear. But again, as I say, you know, the early results sometimes do not reflect the overall result because those early voting papers take longer to process, and that's when you get this delay. So, you know, we will see, but we will be giving you all the information about this. We've got a special program here on the BBC World Service called America Decides. It begins from about 17 hours Eastern Standard Time in the United States, 10 p.m. in London. We'll be bringing you all the results, and it promises to be an interesting one.
NewsHour's James Kumarasamy in Cedarburg in Wisconsin. There is alarm among some election experts at the growing volume of misinformation and false charges of fraud being levelled at the Democrats by Donald Trump and his supporters. Sowing doubt about the integrity of the election is a repeat of Mr. Trump's 2020 playbook. And he has flatly and without evidence called the Democrats a bunch of cheats. His key ally, Elon Musk, has been a big purveyor of such conspiracies on his social media platform X. How widely are these claims believed by Republican supporters? Barbara McCade is a former federal prosecutor in eastern Michigan and author of a book about disinformation called Attack from Within.
It's difficult to assess how widely believed they are. There are reports that a third of all Republican voters believe that the election is rigged. I don't know whether that number is accurate, because I think that in addition to people who truly believe that election fraud occurs, I think there are others who are sort of willing to go along with the con because they prefer the agenda that it advances. But certainly there are some people who do believe these false claims.
Do some of the claims come with any credible evidence?
No, there is no credible evidence of any of these claims. You know, in the 2020 election, there were false claims of election fraud. There were audits, there were lawsuits, there were court hearings, and none of them held up. And now we are preemptively seeing these kinds of claims about the election being stolen and cheats and other kinds of things. I really think that we have a candidate in Donald Trump and some of his supporters who are really just laying the groundwork so that if he loses this election, they will be able to have sensitized people that there's an explanation for it and that the election was stolen or rigged in some way.
What other results could these claims have? Could they lead to violence?
Of course, I think, as we saw in 2020, when people believe that an election has been stolen and when people egg them on, I think it could lead to political violence. When people lose faith in political institutions, I think there are some who will take the law into their own hands. As we saw, there, 1,500 people have been charged criminally with storming our U.S. Capitol on January 6th of 2021. I hope that this time our officials are better prepared to deal with something like that. But I think that there will be those, I hope it's isolated, but who decide to take the law into their own hands. And so I think it's very dangerous to traffic in this kind of disinformation.
Is it dangerous even to talk about the possibility of violence? Some Republicans will say you are scaremongering.
Well, I think that we have to be prepared for every eventual outcome. So to say that there's a possibility of political violence, I think it would be naive to suggest that that's not the case after what we saw in 2020. I think that we need to not scaremonger lest we discourage people from showing up at the polls. And I think that law enforcement at the federal and state level are prepared to protect people who go to the polling places to make sure people are not threatened or harassed or that they see any violence when they go to the polls. So I'm hopeful that things will be safe at the polls, but I do worry that if there's somebody out there who doesn't like the outcome and who is told that it was the result of cheating or fraud, I worry that there could be someone out there who is unstable and decides to take the law into their own hands.
There are Democrats online, aren't there, who suggest baselessly as well that Republicans are cheats. They're not policed either.
Well, I don't know that I have seen those claims with the same propensity that I've seen claims of Donald Trump and his supporters. But no matter who makes a false claim online about the election of an outcome, it is destabilizing to democracy. And this is certainly something our hostile foreign adversaries are pumping into this election, false claims that elections don't work, that they're not fair, that elections can't run smoothly, that democracy is a failed form of government. And then we have people who are willing to bolster those claims to advance their own personal agendas and really acting as the useful idiots of Russia, Iran, and other foreign nations.
We're very close now to the first results being declared. How do you expect the Trump camp to react when the first swing state doesn't fall their way?
Well, we have seen the playbook before in 2020, and we have heard his advisor, Steve Bannon, to try to suggest that Trump should declare victory, even if it doesn't appear that way, and to suggest that he has information others don't have, and that this is just a wave, and we were winning, and then suddenly we were losing. So I'm sure there will be some false narrative that comes out of it. But regardless, I think that voters need to be patient and wait until all the votes are counted, because we will see waves that are blue and red as various parts of each state are counted.
That was Barbara McCade, former federal prosecutor in Michigan and author of a book about disinformation called Attack from Within. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We are live from London. This is NewsHour. Coming up, the European Songbook, seeking to promote better understanding through music.
Stamattina mi sono alzato, oh bella ciao, bella ciao.
70 years we have exchanged more physical things in the European Union, like coal and steel and fish. And when it comes to culture, we have the language barriers, which kind of keeps us in a compartmentalized way of living.
Oh bella ciao.
Coming up a bit later, the headlines. Tens of millions of Americans are voting in a presidential election on a knife edge. Donald Trump cast his ballot in Florida, saying he was confident of success. Kamala Harris has been speaking on radio in key swing states, urging people to vote. Close elections are also expected for the House and the Senate. This is Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has sacked his country's defence minister Yoav Gallant, citing a breakdown in trust, which he said was vital for wartime unity.
The breach of trust between myself and the defence minister has become public, and this breach prevents the campaign from being managed properly. It's not just me who is saying this. Most government ministers and cabinet members, nearly everyone, share the feeling that we cannot continue in this way. In light of this, I decided today to end the term of the defence minister.
There have already been crowds of demonstrators in Tel Aviv protesting against the sacking. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is John Donison. I asked him if there was any love lost between the two men.
No, and there hasn't been for some time. We've heard over the past year there have been reports of shouting matches between the two men over Israel's war strategy in Gaza in particular. Mr. Gallant was very much behind the war when it started just over a year ago. But in recent months, he has said the government should be prioritising a hostage release deal with Hamas ahead of continuing the war. And of course, that's something that Mr. Netanyahu has rejected. So you're right to say no love lost. And that has clearly come to a head today.
Yoav Gallant was often described as a moderate to explain his difference of opinions with the Prime Minister, but he was a strong supporter of the war, wasn't he?
He was, and all these things are relative. He has been pretty hawkish over the past year about the war in Gaza, but his replacement, Israel Katz, is perhaps even more hawkish, and he clearly had strong differences of opinion with Mr. Netanyahu, not just over the war in Gaza, but also the issue of the exemption of Israel's ultra-Orthodox citizens from serving in the military. That is something that he thought shouldn't continue. He'd fallen out with Mr. Netanyahu over that, saying that, you know, the ultra-Orthodox at the time of war in Gaza and also now in Lebanon, they should be serving like everyone else.
Who is protesting in Tel Aviv and why?
Well, the opposition parties in Israel have called for protests this evening, but a lot of those protests are being driven by the Hostage Families Forum, who are very concerned, they say, over the sacking of Mr. Gallant. They have asked that Israel Katz, the new defence minister, should prioritise that hostage deal, something they feel that Mr. Netanyahu has not been doing. So they have been driving those protests. We've had protests also outside the Prime Minister's office here in Jerusalem. Not huge, but they certainly got out on the streets pretty quickly after the news came out. So it is going to be interesting to see how those develop over the coming days. I mean, you cannot ignore also the timing of this. Mr. Gallant had a much better relationship with the White House than the Prime Minister's relationship, which, to be honest, is pretty frosty at best. And the timing of this on the day of the US election, I think, can't be ignored.
And in a sentence or two, will this shore up, this move, Benjamin Netanyahu's support in the country?
Look, I think it's not going to lead to a change of strategy in Gaza or in Lebanon. And Mr. Netanyahu is currently riding pretty high in the polls, and he clearly thought this was a good time to do it.
The BBC's John Donison in Jerusalem. A European Union songbook is launched today, taking in songs selected to give cultural definition to 27 member countries. It is the brainchild of a Danish organisation, which has also translated all 164 songs into singable English language versions. I've been speaking to the founder of the European Union Songbook Association, Jeppe Marsling.
I think for select 70 years we have exchanged more physical things in the European Union, like coal and steel and fish. And when it comes to culture, we have the language barriers, which kind of keeps us in a compartmentalized way of living. So we do know the famous songs from like Italy or France or a few from Germany. But when it comes to the wider European Union, the South, the East, I think very few people actually know each other's culture very well.
So who adjudicated which songs would make it into this songbook, and what were the criteria?
We invited music conservatories, music teacher unions and choir unions to nominate songs before we send it out for public votes, where ordinary people would then choose the final six songs for each member state. So it was a very large adventure involving 400 media and 87,000 people. but it was all worth it.
So the songs that made it, some are pretty well known. There's a bit of Edith Piaf representing France, I hear.
Most Europeans who can sing or play guitar or piano, they would probably know maybe 20, 30 songs out of the 164. And these would be like European classics, like Guten Abend, Guten Nacht, Brahms' Lullaby from Germany, or Bella Ciao from Italy, or Hymne de l'amour, Edith Piaf from France. But when you go beyond that, you realize that very big populations like the Polish people or the Czech people or the Romanians, they also have very deep music culture, and very few people actually outside those countries know of any songs.
Give us an example of a song that might be new and educative about the country that it comes from.
I can mention, for example, To Jasmine, which is the love song that is played for all weddings in Cyprus. And this almost 200 years old song is about a man who comes to visit a girl called Jasmine. The parents are very nervous that he will kidnap her, but he says, "I only came to take care of the jasmine bush in the garden." But if you think about the Eastern European countries, many of them who were occupied for 45 years by the Soviets. And when you actually see these songs in the first chapter of Freedom and Peace, you realize how much sorrow, how much longing that they actually went through. And it's really a privilege to be able to share these feelings with them.
And despite Brexit, there's even a song from the UK, isn't there?
Yes, that was a musical amputation physically for us that we had to pull out the six songs. But we kept Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot or Auld Lang Syne, because this song is a song of friendship. And we hope, of course, the Brits will rejoin the European Union down the line.
It's an old cliche, isn't it, coming together through music. Do you think it's true?
All the songs in the EU songbook, they appear in 25 original languages and in singable English. And it means that you really get into the feelings and the meaning of these songs. You know, the last 10 years, we have traveled around Europe and collected the notes and talked about how to recruit the best translators. And every time you talk about these songs, you get a very direct, heart-to-heart contact with people that you never met. It's truly magical with music. And we call it European English because it is English spoken as a second language or sung. And it is not perfect. We foremost want to meet each other through this language.
That was Jeppe Marsling in Denmark from the European Union Songbook Association. You're listening to NewsHour live from London. This is the BBC World Service. Much more to come.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. bbc.com/news offers you the most comprehensive news coverage in the world, and its stories are easy to search and navigate. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. If you want to take the news with you, we offer you downloadable podcasts to listen at your convenience, or archive programming so you can catch up on the programmes you've missed. Or you can access bbc.com/news on your mobile phone. bbc.com/news also lets you give feedback direct to our programme teams. All this content, coverage and opportunity makes the BBC the world leader in news coverage online.
Still to come on NewsHour, the Spanish Prime Minister promises billions in help after the deadly floods in eastern Spain, the spread of Israel's war in Lebanon, and we ask what would happen if the US election ended with precisely the same number of Electoral College votes for each candidate. It is statistically possible. Here's the news. Welcome back to NewsHour. Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has announced $11 billion worth of aid and reconstruction measures for Valencia and other areas hit by massive floods a week ago. Everyone affected will be able to claim tens of thousands of dollars in assistance for repairing damaged homes and replacing belongings.
We know that this is not enough, that there are still missing people who need to be found, destroyed homes and businesses buried under the mud, and many people who are suffering severe shortages. And that is why we have to continue working without distractions, with more resources, with more coordination, and with greater effort.
The disaster killed at least 217 people and dozens of others are still unaccounted for. Our Europe correspondent Bethany Bell sent this report from Valencia.
I'm in a park near the Turia River in Valencia, in front of an ever-growing mound of debris. Bulldozers and pickup trucks are bringing the contents of people's homes. Mud-stained mattresses, fridges, ovens, all destroyed, ruined in the mud and water.
There was water in houses. People don't have where to stay.
Close by, I met Kautar, a student, covered in mud. She's one of thousands of volunteers helping to clean up people's homes. She told me it's difficult work.
It's so sad, horrible. Like, you see people crying, people lost their homes, some people that lost family.
Yeah.
They need some help because it's not normal to wake up and find that your neighbors are dead.
Thousands of soldiers, police and emergency workers are here as part of what Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has called the biggest peacetime deployment in his country's history. Jorge is from the Spanish Marines.
The catastrophe is big.
What are you doing?
Only cleaner, 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 cleaner.
Businesses have been hit hard too. Bus Motor, a small company which sells cleaning products online, has its warehouse in Picanha, one of the worst affected areas close to Valencia. Its press officer, Diego Navarro Rodriguez, says they've lost almost all their stock.
First, we need to get the mud out of the warehouse. From there, see how we can recover and how the central Spanish government and aid agencies are responding. At the moment, nothing much is getting through.
It will take weeks, if not months, before the extent of the damage is clear.
That was our Europe correspondent Bethany Bell reporting from Valencia on the Spanish Mediterranean coast. This is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley. Israel's war in Lebanon with the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group is expanding. The Bekaa Valley, the militant group's heartland in the east of the country, is coming under increasing attack. In the last week, more than 160 people have been killed in Israeli strikes there. Israel says it only targets Hezbollah sites, but rescue workers with Lebanon's Civil Defense Force say a large number of civilians, including women and children, are being killed. Our correspondent Quentin Somerville reports, and a warning, listeners might find some of the testimonies in his report disturbing.
Samir, what's going through your head when you're going to a strike?
Basically, I'm calculating the situation in my head, focusing if there are victims, if there is a fire, if there was another airstrike.
Samir Ishkia is 32 years old. For the last 14 years, he's been part of Lebanon's Civil Defence Force.
He's the CDF's head of operations in Zahle, in the Bekaa Valley, in the east of the country.
There's been an Israeli strike on an apartment block in El Karak, just minutes from his station. He's at the wheel of the ambulance on his way to the scene.
So two buildings have been affected, but one has taken a direct hit, and it's partly collapsed at the bottom here. And we believe these are displaced people from the south of Lebanon who've been living here. The firemen are now closing down the site. This is a daily occurrence in this area, and the civil defence staff are telling us that when they arrive at a scene, there's half a dozen casualties that they're seeing every time. The smoke is getting pretty thick here. Even in 2006, the last war with Israel, there was nothing like the intensity of these bombardments.
Meanwhile, Samir is deep in the rubble. There are survivors underneath the pancake floors of the apartment block. A fire is still blazing within, so when he finds a child, he doesn't have protective plastic gloves on. He can feel the shattered bones beneath his fingertips. As he carefully retrieves the child, he realises it's only half a body, as he tells me afterwards.
First victim I found was a child. I don't know if it's a girl or a boy, because it was a half child. Sorry to explain that, but it's from the stomach and up. From stomach and down, there is nothing. It's hard. It's too hard. We found a 8 to 10 year old girl, and she told us that her infant brother is next to her. And after that, we started hearing the screaming of a small child, a 7-8 month child. The hearing of that child crying, it gives you strength. You get stronger. We got in between the rocks, and we passed him out to our paramedics.
Do you feel like a hero?
We're not heroes. We're doing our job. The victim who is still alive under the ground, he's the hero. This kid that we took out yesterday, he's the hero.
Samir says the strike left 6 dead, including 3 children.
The boy Samir rescued, 8-month-old Mohammed Ramadan, is now recovering in Iraq.
Israeli drones buzz overhead constantly. The contrails from its warplanes scar the bright blue sky above the Bekaa. At night, Hezbollah rockets could be heard on more than half a dozen occasions being launched from nearby. I spent more than 2 weeks with the CDF in the Bekaa, in tiny rural fire stations among fruit orchards and vineyards which carpet this fertile valley. The pattern of Israeli strikes and civilian casualties would be repeated again and again. Last Monday was one of the most intense bombardments on Baalbek, a city with a UNESCO-protected site of sprawling and magnificent Roman temples. With pickaxes and shovels, local men and boys dig through the ruins of another home.
We're right by some of the Roman fortifications, and an entire house was wiped out here. I'd say 5 people were killed. The locals say that there's been a shift in the Israeli targeting, that they are increasingly targeting not military infrastructure, Hezbollah infrastructure, but civilian homes and apartments. So just here, among all this rubble, I mean, there's nothing that looks like a home here now. In fact, there's a destroyed car over here. Is Hussein, he's 42 years old. He's lived here his entire life.
Hi, Umra Mitsini, hi, Al-Faransi. Marufi, yani.
This was built 100 years ago during the French Mandate. No terrorist or bad person lived here. We were born here and have always lived here, and we won't leave.
Israel said it had struck 110 Hezbollah-linked targets that day. Some two-thirds of the 63 killed were women and children, according to local officials. And the wards of the local hospital are crowded with the injured.
The cries you can hear in the background at Dar Amal Hospital, I'm in the children's intensive care unit, are from 3-year-old Celine. She's lying in a hospital bed, she's covered in bandages. She has burns to her face. An Israeli airstrike hit her home, killing both her parents. She's crying for her mum and dad. 2 of her sisters were also killed. Her brother was killed. 5-year-old sister survived. She left the hospital.
More than 2,700 people in Lebanon have been killed since the start of the war, but a quarter of them are women and children. In the next room is 2-year-old Kian. He was wounded in an Israeli airstrike. He's lying in a hospital bed. All he wants is his mum, Najat. She's by his bedside.
I'm crying because I'm afraid for my baby. If they think they can break us, they're mistaken. Even if I have to sacrifice my son, my husband, my father, my mother, my sister, and myself.
In the last month, Israel has unquestionably diminished Hezbollah's military might. But the group's strength has deeper roots, and here in the Bekaa Valley, its bombing campaign and the high civilian toll is for now hardening, not weakening, support for the group.
The BBC's Quentin Somerville reporting from Lebanon. A new film, 5 years in the making, that documents the violence and brutality of Israel's occupation of the West Bank, has just won the second annual Anna Politkovskaya Aman Soldin Prize. It was awarded to the Israeli journalist Yuval Abraham and Palestinian journalist Basil Adra. Their film is called No Other Land.
1,000 Palestinians face one of the single biggest expulsion decisions since the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories began in 1967.
The voice you heard at the end of that trailer, in a scene that shows a bulldozer destroying one of the homes in a West Bank village, is the voice of Basil Adra. He started documenting the actions of the Israeli army and police in his village at the age of 15. My colleague Julian Warwicker spoke to both filmmakers, Basil Adra first.
They wanted to show to the world, they wanted to be the storyteller of my community and showing what's happening to our life, that we're living in this community. And they wanted to tell the people outside that we exist, we are living here, and look at the unjust that we are facing, in a way that requesting help from the world toward what we are facing.
So even early on, you had a wider audience in mind, did you?
Yes, always I wanted to reach more and more audience. So I start using my social media to try on create an audience that they would see and know and care about what we are facing and what we are living in.
So Yuval, tell me about how the working relationship developed. How much mistrust was there between you at that point?
Me and Basil are the same age. We live under Israeli rule, but I'm under civilian law and Basil is under military law. We're living under two different systems of law. I can come to Basil. Basil cannot come to me. He's locked in the occupied West Bank. And obviously, it took time to build trust. And I think what brought us together is a sense of shared values. The fact that, yes, I'm Israeli, but I'm very much opposed to the occupation and to the policies that the Israeli government is currently doing, which is why I believe there needs to be sanctions on Israel.
Basil, tell me about your sentiments early on when you first met Yuval, and I think there's a moment in the film, isn't there, where he sort of eats with you and your family for the first time.
Generally, like Masafir Yatta community is used, and we in the community used to receive international and Israeli solidarity activists who would come and stay in our villages because they are coming in solidarity against and opposing the occupation. And for that, the community hosts them. This is how I met Yuval.
Yuval, I wanted to ask you specifically, you've made your political view of this situation very clear. You would presumably acknowledge, at least now, that your viewpoint, an Israeli viewpoint, is a minority one. And indeed, you've been attacked as being against Jewish people as a result of what you're doing. How do you respond to that?
First of all, you're absolutely right. I am a minority. You know, I've made a speech where I called for equality and very basic things that I believe, you know, a belief in human rights. And it was labeled as even as anti-Semitic by some German politicians. And, you know, as someone whose family, much of it was murdered in the Holocaust, and sees how anti-Semitism is very real and rising all over the world on the left and on the right, I take very serious issue with that, because I think that when you use this thing when you label people as traitors or as or Zuaiters to silence a very valid criticism of what Israel is doing. You know, the UN humanitarian chief says that 400,000 people in the north of Gaza are now at risk of dying. So it's very, very urgent. And to use such a heavy word to silence those critics, in my mind, is appalling, not only because of the silencing, but also because it empties the word anti-Semitism of meaning.
In which case, what do you want the mainstream Israeli audience who watch this film to take away from it?
It's in our interest of Israelis to end the occupation, because I believe that security is always going to be a mutual endeavor. Me and Basil have for years before October 7th, I mean, we've been protesting and we've been organizing nonviolent resistance, and it's all been squashed violently by the military. And I believe that if you block every single path, every single nonviolent legal path for Palestinian statehood and freedom, then the likelihood of violence becomes greater. This is not justifying violence ever. You know, any killing of Israeli civilian or Palestinian civilian is wrong morally, and people should be held accountable for those killings. But when you block all of those paths, you are condemning all of us, I believe, to a situation of constant violence and destruction. And I hope that people who watch the film, who really see how the army is destroying houses and water wells and schools, and doing so just to prevent a Palestinian state, I hope they will understand how wrong it is morally and how bad it is on the long term for us as well.
Filmmakers Yuval Abraham, who's Israeli, and Basil Adra, who's Palestinian, their film won Best Documentary at the Berlin Film Festival. It hasn't yet been granted distribution rights in the US. This is NewsHour. This is NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Now, it's often been said about this election in the US that it is too close to call. What if it's still too close to call once all the results are in? The Electoral College vote that decides who is president could end up being a precise tie. Elaine Kamark has studied various scenarios, including that one. She is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Why was it, I asked her, that the US decided its president by an electoral college rather than by the winner of the popular vote?
Well, it's hard to justify it, although if you go back in history, it was completely justifiable because it was one of the most important compromises in the Constitutional Convention that got the small states to sign on to the Union along with the big states. Because otherwise, a lot of the small states, South Carolina, Delaware, places like that, would have been swamped by Massachusetts and Virginia, which in those days were the big populous states. So the creation of the Electoral College, the creation of the Senate, are the direct result of the compromises needed to form the Union in the first place.
Right. And is it possible that Harris and Trump could tie precisely in terms of Electoral College votes?
It is absolutely possible. 269 and 269. And yes, it's totally, totally possible.
Has it happened before?
It has happened in 1800 when Thomas Jefferson ran against John Adams. And the provisions are in the Constitution for that to happen. And it goes into the House of Representatives. And in 1800, Thomas Jefferson won, but it took 36 ballots in the House of Representatives and some defections from Alexander Hamilton's wing of the Federalist Party to make Thomas Jefferson the president.
If it happened in 2024, one might assume that the fairest way of deciding it would be to turn to the popular vote and just count the votes and then declare the winner. But it wouldn't work like that, would it?
No, unfortunately, it would not work like that. Although, frankly, if we got to that point, we may have a bit of a constitutional crisis. The way it would work is that the election would go into the House of Representatives. And the problem here, which is a direct result of the compromise I spoke about a moment ago, is that every state in the House has one vote. So that means that California, with its 50 plus members of Congress, has the same vote as Wyoming with barely any people and only one congressional district. So it's vastly unfair. And of course, it depends on which party controls the congressional districts in the House. So if there's a majority for the Democrats in one state, then that one vote will probably be cast for the Democrats. But as you can imagine, there's just horribly distorting and could certainly be very unfair.
I suppose how big a constitutional crisis that proved would depend on who was declared the winner.
Well, that's right. Well, although, frankly, either way, it's bound to be a mess. Now, you could imagine a situation where you have some profiles in courage and where a state delegation decides to cast its one vote for the winner of the popular vote, even if the delegation itself favors the other party. You could imagine that happening, and that would probably avert the crisis. But bottom line is, it's a mess. It's a mess.
Elaine Kamark, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. We'll go back to our main story. As the vote continues, the BBC's Samira Hussain is in Washington. Samira, I hear you're at Kamala Harris's HQ. What is the mood like there first?
Well, the risers are set. Media is absolutely jam-packed here, and they're waiting for the results. Kamala Harris spent the day this morning doing some radio interviews and encouraging people to go out and cast their ballots, but then was up to some pretty vice presidential duties by going to meetings and, getting daily briefings. A kind of monotony in the routine to sort of distract perhaps from the enormity of what is actually happening. Later today, she actually made her way to the Democratic headquarters here, and she was also on the phone calling supporters. And eventually she's going to go home, and she's going to have a quiet dinner at home with her family before she makes her way over to Howard University, which is where I am right now.
Donald Trump is going to spend the evening with Elon Musk, is he not? And there's been more trademark confidence from him.
Yes, and I think that's something that you're going to hear from both campaigns at this stage, that they are confident in the kind of campaign that they have run and that they are confident that their particular candidate is going to win. That's kind of the way American politics works at this point in the game. But if you look at the polls, for months, they have been at a tie, statistical ties. Poll after poll have been showing that. And so we're come now to the end of this political campaign, and it seems that the election remains just that tight.
There's been some disruption to the voting in Georgia, reports of a bomb hoax.
Yeah, there have been actually some around 30 bomb hoaxes that have targeted election-related locations across the country, according to a few law enforcement officials. And there have been about 17 fake bomb threats that have targeted the state of Georgia alone. Now, officials are working to try and figure out where they have come from, but they do believe that it is possible that they could be part of a foreign effort to disrupt the election. So this is something that, of course, the FBI and other law enforcement officials are watching very, very closely.
What can we expect, Samira, in the next few hours?
In the next few hours, you'll hear perhaps some results that are coming in very slowly. But, you know, this is one of these elections in which we're probably not going to get the result for a very long time. I mean, remember at the last election when U.S. President Joe Biden won, we didn't get that until about a few days later, about 4 or 5 days later. So many people are expecting, given the polls are just so razor tight, that it's going to be a long haul before we find out who will be the next president of the United States.
And there's not just the occupancy of the White House at stake, also Congress?
Absolutely. And so at stake is also who's going to control House and the House of Representatives, and then who is going to control the Senate. And unbelievably, all of those races, you know, basically polls are saying it's also a toss-up there. So it's going to be a nail-biter of a couple days. So I hope no one clipped their nails just yet.
Thank you very much, Samira Hussain. Previewing the long run-up to the announcement of a result in the US elections and wrapping up this edition of NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening. If you can, enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.